It is Saturday, September 18th, 2012. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio, Santa Cruz. Today on Geek Speak, geek news in the first half and the second half, a discussion about supporting women in open technology and culture with ADA Initiative's Executive Director, Valerie Arora. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. In the air with me, I have Mr. Ben Jaffe. He's a freelancer and media guy. Hey, Ben.
Yo.
And Mr. Miles Elam is also in the air. Miles is a political junkie and programmer.
Good morning.
We also have Valerie Arora. Valerie Arora is an open source developer and expert on the Unix and Linux operating system file structures. Good morning, Valerie.
Morning.
Thanks for joining us. Now, we'll be talking more with Valerie about the ADA Initiative, a wonderful project to support women in open technology. And we'll be talking about that in about half an hour. And Valerie, please feel free. Any geek news you'd like to participate in, you're more than welcome to do so. We're just going to run through a little bit of things that piqued our interest this week. I'm Lyle Troxell. Ben?
Yeah, so I want to talk about Star Trek because I always like talking about Star Trek.
Because you're a geek.
Because I'm, well, not all geeks are into Star Trek. Some are Star Wars geeks, and some are kind of agnostic like me, although I do enjoy Star Trek more personally. But there actually is some good Star Trek news this week. So a couple things. First of all, we all remember the most recent Star Trek film. It was kind of the reboot, the J.J. Abrams one, and it was it kind of catered to a more general crowd as well, as opposed to just the Star Trek fanboys. Well, it turns out they're actually making another J.J. Abrams and Paramount Star Trek movie. It's going to be in 2013. That's next year. And the sequel title is almost confirmed, but confirmed enough that people are reporting on it. It's called Star Trek Into Darkness.
Hmm. Do you know anything about the plot points or anything?
It presumably includes darkness
and Star Trek.
Some Star Trek. I mean, you know, we don't. I linked to this article that I read in the show notes, but it's kind of really hilarious. Basically, they say, like, this is the new title for the J.J. Abrams movie. Paramount hasn't officially confirmed the news, but they did reserve the domains. And then there's this, like, long paragraph talking about, like, how, well, maybe it's there's darkness in it or
yeah.
Something. Or
okay, like, we've done enough of the description of it. But it did be exciting to see the show. The last Star Trek episode, it was
a good movie. Yeah, I didn't think it was as much of a Star Trek movie in the Gene Roddenberry or the kind of Star Trek we're accustomed to. But it was a good movie. It was really entertaining and fun and everything. And also, Michael Dorn, known to Star Trek fans as Worf. Yes, the Klingon guy, in an interview, talked about how he's going to pitch a new Star Trek series called Captain Worf.
That could be fun.
That will be very fun, if it happens.
Wait a second. There can't be a Captain Worf.
Well, he transferred to Command. When he transferred to Deep Space Nine, he
Why
transferred
not?
From
yes,
Security
except
to Command.
Yes, that on the episode where he was supposed to work with Dax to get the Cardassian spy off of the planet, he chose to save his wife Dax instead of the Cardassian and got a tongue lashing for it. So everyone understood, but as was said by Captain Sisko, this will probably keep you from ever getting a command.
Yeah,
we are moving on.
Thank you guys.
I will fade you out if necessary.
No. I just want to quickly
check this out. Bye-bye. All right, so we're going to... Wait. Go ahead, Ben. I'm sorry.
Most captains have done completely irresponsible stuff. Picard got stabbed by a Nausicaa and started a bar fight. I mean, come on.
Everyone that's listening, I'm so sorry. Wait, I mean all three of you. So let's talk a little bit about... I do a lot of chainsaw work on the place where I live. I do a lot of dropping trees and stuff, and I feel a little bit woodsman-y. So I'm not always just a nerd. but most of the time I am. And I'm very interested in new material science. So, Miles, can you do new material science and wood?
Yes. The Forest Products Laboratory of the U.S. Forest Service has started a manufacturing plant, to produce what are called CNCs, cellulose nanocrystals. And they're from wood byproducts. So wood chips, sawdust, other things that are often used for maybe particle board or just stuff that you can't use otherwise, like cheaper materials. Well, it turns out that when properly prepared, CNCs are stronger and stiffer than Kevlar or carbon fiber.
Hmm? That's surprising. How are they produced?
Sorry?
How is it stronger? What is it doing chemically?
So what you're going to want to do is then look at the article that will be linked on the GeekSpeak website after the show. But at the same time, they're less than 10% the cost of Kevlar fiber or carbon fiber. So imagine, you know, your carbon fiber bike, except that the materials for it end up being a lot cheaper.
Right.
Is this in production right now, or is it in a research?
No, this is a pilot project. Although they are putting some money behind it, and they do have some working prototypes, but we don't know whether or not it can go to a large scale, because that's really the test, whether or not you can get it from the laboratory to a large scale. Another side aspect to it is that these carbon nanocrystals are transparent.
Oh, that's different than Kevlar or...
Yeah, so while it has obvious things for the automotive, aerospace, electronics, medical... the military is also using it would be looking at it for things like lightweight armor, ballistic glass.
Right. So
and building Wonder Woman's airplane.
And building Wonder Woman's airplane.
Perfect. So the thing that actually holds the structure together, this pulp, is transparent. That's not the fibrous material, right? I mean, isn't it the case that when you're talking about like carbon sheets, there's the bonder and there's also the carbon,
right.
Like lattice, and that the lattice adds the rigidity, and then the binder actually makes it, glues it together, basically. Is this, which one of these is that? The pulp itself, is it fibrous, or is it just, do you know the details of that?
It is fibrous. It is using the cellulose as a base material for rigidity.
Yeah, cool. Very cool. Valerie, thanks for chiming in. I when I have another person on the phone, I couldn't even contact you directly. I couldn't text with you. I'm like, does she have a story? Does she want to say something? So if you do have a news story or anything, please feel free to join us and chime in. Do you have one right now that you want to talk about, something in the news this week?
No.
Okay, good.
Good. This week isn't up for politics. So.
Yeah. Okay, so Ben, what's up in California?
Okay, this is really exciting for me because I live a 10-minute drive away from Moffett Field. Guess what's happening at Moffett Field, or above Moffett Field, I should
say. Last week we were talking
20th.
About the vomit comet and Google's plane that allows you to do a zero G. But
so yeah, speaking of modified aircraft,
right?
They
it's
are
not that though.
They are flying the Shuttle Endeavour on its final flight. So we were talking a bit before about which shuttle was? Do you guys remember what shuttle it was? The final flight we were talking about?
Discovery, I thought.
Discovery,
it was.
Yeah. So Discovery made its final flight. Well, now Endeavour, the space shuttle Endeavour, will make its final flight on top of this modified Boeing aircraft, 747. And they're going to be flying it all around so people can see it before it gets retired and sent over to Los Angeles. So the really cool thing about this is it's leaving Edwards Air Force Base, and then it's flying right near NASA's Ames Research Center at Moffett Field at like 1,500 feet or 2,000 feet above the ground.
So
we're going to be actually able to see it. So if anybody is in Santa Cruz or really the whole San Francisco Bay Area, go look at this thing. It's going to be awesome. It's probably the only...
Huh? The date again?
The date is September 20th, and it'll be probably the only time that you'll ever be able to see a shuttle flying, considering again that they're all being retired, you know?
So is it really a shuttle flight when you don't feel and hear the sonic booms?
Well, the shuttle is technically flying. Well, it's being flown.
Right. Right. It's being transported.
Yeah. I don't know. Wind is going over its wings. at high speeds.
Oh, but wait, in the Superman reboot movie,
oh no,
the shuttle engines went off and the 747 ended up going past Mach 2 or whatever it was. Yeah.
So just a
not
couple,
a big fan of that reboot.
Also, if you're in San Francisco, it will probably be flying up and up by San Francisco and also Sacramento. So if we have any Sacramento listeners, and if anyone sees this thing, write in and tell us.
Oh, take pictures.
Yeah, take pictures. Awesome. Send us pictures. That'd be awesome. We'll be sure to show them on the radio.
We'll mention it as a geek bit.
And for a geek bit, I have a photo in my hand. That's all.
Cool. The shuttle flies again. Anyway, one last time.
I'm going to see it.
Thank you. September 20th,
September 20th.
Central California. Miles, what's up? You're up, sir.
Yes, the UK government is looking to pass what many critics are calling the snooping bill. It is mandating that ISPs track where an internet user is surfing at the page level, not just the site level, seeing which articles they're looking at, things like that. And it has come upon a lot of criticism from internet luminaries such as Sir Tim Berners-Lee, who is known as being the father of the World Wide Web, who accuses of being draconian internet snooping, and Jimmy Wales, who is the CEO behind the Wikimedia Foundation, or mm-hmm. Wikipedia. And in fact, the latter, Mr. Wales, has stated that if the UK passes this bill, they're going to switch Wikipedia to being a default
SSL.
Yeah, HTTPS.
Mm-hmm. And okay, so let's back up on just
what does
second.
That mean?
Right now, you can visit Wikipedia site directly without enforcing a handshake that makes it a private connection the entire time. Therefore, if you had any kind of snooping going on, you could see all the traffic you'd be doing. And we're talking about a site that has a lot of traffic. So, and of course, it's very comparable to a library. And for years, we've had this privacy concern that a local government could look at kind of books you're checking out, and there could be some kind of privacy snooping at that level. And that's normally librarians frown upon that quite a bit. In this situation with Wikipedia, if the UK government allows this kind of snooping, then people could see the type of traffic people are looking at.
Mandates
Wikipedia.
The types of
mandates.
Yeah, it's talking to about creepy. USPs having to track this data.
That's nasty. Ooh. And so what Jimmy Wales, the person that runs and founded Wikipedia and runs the Wikimedia Group, I think still, he is saying, well, we'll just enforce encryption so that every handshake with the Wikipedia servers is private from start to finish, and you can't snoop on it.
Yes, so that's what happens with a lot of private services like Gmail, for example.
We've seen a lot of that happen in the last few years. Facebook has forced that now.
Mm-hmm.
So, what do you think?
Wikipedia is available through HTTPS, but you have to explicitly say, I want the HTTPS version.
And you know, you should, right? I mean, don't you think? It's not really much overhead. You might as well.
Right. And that's what Jimmy Wales has told the UK Parliament is that, or told members of Parliament, that it would be a trivial technical change to make it so that it always defaults to HTTPS.
Right. It's basically it's a one line redirect that occurs.
Well,
and then
that.
A little bit more traffic load. Well, I mean, it's a little bit more load. You can't proxy. There's a few things that right now is available because SSL is not forced that wouldn't be.
Right. At the same time, even though it's a little bit more overhead, yes, proxying is affected, although you can have proxy servers that get it unencrypted and then pass it on. That's neither here nor there. But you also have this aspect of browsers nowadays that you can tell them this
always
is
try
one of the
HTTPS.
Sites that is always going to be HTTPS.
That's right, yeah.
And so it really is a trivial technical change.
It's funny because I kind of support the idea of going complete HTTPS, you know, doing
yes.
that handshakes everywhere. I haven't done that on the GeekSpeak site, of course, because the SSL certificate costs like $120 a month or so, a year.
Actually,
is it less?
There's a way to do it another way, and I'll talk to you about it.
Let's do that, because we're running Nginx. We totally put an SSL cert on there. Because the truth is, there's no reason really not to do it. And we kind of infer a privacy situation when we're on our own laptop and we're communicating with a server that we trust. We assume that no one is looking in on us. But the truth is, if you're not using an encrypted protocol, your ISP could be, right? Somebody in the chain could be snooping the entire time.
Just to do a little quick background for folks who aren't as familiar with SSL or with HTTPS TLS. This not only encrypts, but the idea behind these certificates is it also tells you that you are, in fact, talking to who you think you're talking to. And right. so over time, different levels of SSL cert have come about. So some of them are exhaustive, like, are you at a corporation? Let's get a certified document, and we're going to do some research on you. And that's usually when you see the big green moniker at the top of the screen.
Hopefully
that says
your bank should
your,
say be
yeah, Citibank, you know, has that big thing on there. But there's also certificate authorities such as Start SSL, and they will provide ones for free as long as you have a contact point.
Right.
And so if you are have balked
so it's
at the
to move
cost
in.
Of an SSL cert, but you still want to have an encryption. So in other words, you want to have the encryption, but if there's just a minimal check to see who you think you are, you just want to make sure that you have an encrypted channel there. There are options such as Start SSL.
Okay, so just a quick breakdown again of the story. There's a new potential law in the UK government that would force ISPs to start tracking their user information so that when the government came to ask, they could provide data.
Yeah,
that's
keep records for 12 months. Yeah,
12 months of all internet activity. And of course, we don't like this idea. It's bad policy. To collect lots of data just means there's a lot more data in the world. And it doesn't... necessarily lead to good police work.
There's a lot more data.
The thing is,
it has a large potential for abuse.
Yes, thank you. That was a secondary problem with it. Any case, and to support that this is ridiculous, Jimmy Wales of Wikipedia, the Wikimedia Foundation, has said we'll start encrypting everything to hide that, and other providers of content would do the same. I'm assuming.
Right, and he has said the data retention bill is quote. Not the sort of thing I'd expect from a Western democracy. It's the kind of thing I would expect from the Iranians or the Chinese.
Well, he's judgmental, isn't he?
Well, that's the thing, though, is that you have the UK and many other countries, including the US, saying that they support freedom of speech. They are bastions of this ability to speak your mind and have the ability to say things without repercussion or without anonymity.
And this kind of snooping does not... suggest that that's what the government actually believes.
Right. Yeah. Or it's contrary to that.
Yeah. Thank you very much for that. You can learn everything we're talking about, more information at geekspeak.org. We do have links to all the stuff we talk about, including Ben's next story, which I hope is about your Kindle.
Yes. If you've listened to the show for any amount of time, you know that I'm a fan of my Kindle because it lets me read and travel around without heavy books.
Amazon, the human corporation.
I don't love Amazon, but I think that they're doing a very, very good job considering that they're an evil corporation. You know, like when you compare them to Apple or whoever
well,
else,
I think every corporation.
Google.
But in any case, what do you like about the Kindle?
I mean, I like a lot of things about the Kindle, but they just released a new Kindle. Actually, they released a new Kindle Fire, which is their tablet, not to be confused with the e-reader with the screen that looks like paper. That's just the normal Kindle, and they just released a new normal Kindle as well. They call it the Paper White Kindle because the screen is wider and the text is darker, so it looks more like paper. Just kind of cool. It's very lightweight and it's very thin and it lasts a really long time because it only needs to use power when you change the page. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I also 8 weeks, as a matter of fact, according to their estimates.
Wow. 8 weeks is, that's a long time.
Well, they base that on reading 30 minutes a day.
Yeah, 30 minutes a day, although
totally
the backlight is on.
For me, whatever.
How much do you read a day, Valerie?
Hours.
Yeah. Yeah. But the other thing about this, though, and this is not in this news story. This happened a couple weeks ago, but I feel it's worth mentioning. Before you could get unlimited internet through their crummy little WebKit browser, which is really, really annoying to use. But in a pinch, you know, you could be stranded somewhere in the middle of Siberia and, you know, connect to the cell phone towers for free and find yourself a map.
There are cell phone towers in Siberia?
I don't know.
Go
in
on.
Some places in Siberia, I'm sure. But in any case, and I actually used that once I was at trying to meet up with some couch surfers at a couch surfing event in Belgium or something, and I found out that the event was canceled because I had the WebKit browser, and that was really nice.
But it hasn't been a very good browser. It's just
a good browser.
Last minute def, you know, you're stuck in a city, you forgot to have a bed that night, that kind of thing.
Yeah, so they don't want people using this browser for normal web surfing, you know, but the amazing thing, it actually does work with Google Maps and with Facebook and with, you know, whatever website you need, pretty much. It's just a WebKit browser. But they have taken the unlimited you know, unlimited data mm-hmm. wherever you are, and they've actually they've
truncated it.
So now it's something like 50 megabytes or something, yeah. or 100. I can't remember the number, but
250 megabytes a month.
250. So 250 is still a pretty modest.
And you
number.
Left out the most important part.
What's the most important part?
Which that?
There's this very unique front layer down the front that allows a light to come in from the side and come down only towards the page, the very white page. And so it will, instead of a tablet, which is backlit and the light's coming directly at your eyes, which for me is very tiring, and the reason that I got the Kindle in the first place, now the light bounces off that page just like it does when you're reading a normal book.
Oh, that's great. Do you have one of the new ones?
Really easy on the eyes and very clear.
Sorry, you don't have one of the new ones.
So I have this picture of like these four different layers that go into making this.
The paper white one is better at that kind of capability of taking the light from the sides and throwing it back and reflecting it. This is a new feature of the new one?
A backlight, a light in general, yeah.
Yeah, it didn't have a light before. You would have to buy a case and put the case on it and everything. And it had a little power source where it would connect to the Kindle itself and take power from the battery and everything, so that was kind of nice. But you had to actually buy a case, and it was a fairly bulky case, too. So yeah, that's the other advantage of
this. So, Valerie, are you going to pick up one of these new ones, too?
Oh, I'm already pre-ordered.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Committed. Yeah. Clearly an
but
avid
there's
reader.
Yet another aspect to this new Kindle Touch.
Okay.
This
is the Touch?
Yeah.
This new one's called a Touch?
It is a Touch.
The paper white. It is a touch surface. Okay, go on.
In that the previous Touch was infrared-based in terms of where you were touching and how you were touching. So if an errant hair or something like that would come across, it could trigger it.
Mm-hmm.
This one is a capacitive screen. So it actually will look for...
You need to pull electrons from this thing.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
You actually need to touch it with your finger.
All right, cool.
But you guys missed the most important part. No, I'm just kidding.
That's pretty impressive, you guys. All right, Miles, I think we have time for one more story. What's going on with Flash and Internet Explorer? Things we don't talk about very much.
Well, multimedia, Macromedia Flash, or actually Adobe Flash now. I'm dating myself.
Macromedia Flash.
I know, I'm dating myself.
Oh my God, that was like 40 years ago.
Has been, as the 10-year-old says.
Yes.
Right.
Has been a major source of web exploits of late. And not necessarily just because Flash has had vulnerabilities in their plugin, but because users have not been updating the Flash plugin. Well, Adobe has been a lot more aggressive in doing those updates. The problem now is that browsers such as Internet Explorer 10 and Chrome are bundling Adobe Flash with their browser, and that bundled version is not updatable by Adobe.
I see. So the browser vendor needs to make sure they're on top of it.
Yes. And if they fall behind, then a user has no recourse.
I wonder if one of the reasons why the update's not happening as much is that servers are detecting whether their browser supports HTML5 video streaming. And if it does, it just skips the Flash player. So you go to YouTube with a current browser, you don't even use Flash anymore. Is that a possibility?
Internet Explorer is still, 45% of the market? I don't know that that's really a safe bet yet.
Because HTML5 video is not happening on Internet Explorer. The Flash is happening.
Well, 10 it would be. You're talking about 9 as well.
But
so you're saying it's not necessarily a good thing that 10 has it bundled unless Microsoft's really on top of their updates, which they traditionally have not been.
Unless they are coordinating with Adobe and getting those updates pushed out.
Absolutely.
Unfortunately, Adobe's release dates, security updates, are going to be at release at different points as Microsoft, and so synchronization may end up being a little difficult between them. And this is one area where I really wish that both OS X and, but in this case, Windows, supported something like what Linux has had for many years, which is multiple components that you have through a Debian file and being able to update it where you have multiple vendors all being able to work together into a single mesh.
So my name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Mr. Miles Elam, and Ben Jaffe. And on the phone is Valerie Arora. And Valerie Arora is the co-founder of the ADA Initiative, a nonprofit for increasing the status and participation of women in open source software, Wikipedia-related projects, open data, and similar areas, what they call open technology and culture. Valerie brings to the ADA Initiative over 10 years' experience as an open source software developer specializing in Linux file system. And actually, Valerie, Linux and Unix file systems, correct?
Yes, I usually don't bother mentioning the time I worked on Solaris.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, you know, I was reading your some of your early history articles and stuff. You're talking about Unix, and I was thinking, okay, yeah, she's a Unix file system. So I'm glad that you've made the shift, as the world has, to Linux.
Well, I'm actually curious, which file systems?
Did I work on for Solaris, ZFS,
and also for Linux?
I worked on UC2, 3. I have worked with XFS and ButterFS. Oh, and I did something called Union Mounts, which is not necessarily a file system. It's just a way to stack them on top of each other.
Very cool.
And a couple of other smaller things. You're running my code.
He's on a Mac right now, so is he?
Well, I have it in a virtual. That's fine.
You have a virtual Linux? Okay,
yeah, good. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, good. Your code's being run by all of us, probably. I have a few more station business things to do, but first I'm going to go ahead and invite the geeks to participate with a geek bit, if you've got one.
I do. I have one. It's an article called How to Keep a Riderless Bike from Crashing, and it talks about the physics behind why bicycles can steer themselves and why you can take your hands off the handlebars, and how a lot of the effects that scientists and that you know, people like me also have thought were the determining factors in whether a bike stays upright are not necessarily the factors which are necessary. Like, for example, the wheel rotating really fast, you get an effect there where it's resistant to turning, but that actually isn't a tremendous
effect on why it stays up.
Yeah, it doesn't actually play a huge role. So anyway, very interesting article. I'll put it up in geekspeak.org. And it's got a video of a riderless bike, which they designed to minimize the things that they thought kept bikes up. And it's steering itself. It's
kind of cool. Miles, got one? A geek bit, of course, is a bit of information that we really have to see to believe. You go to geekspeak.org to see it.
Yes. University of Central Florida, shortest laser pulse ever recorded.
We did one of these a while ago. How short is it?
67 attaseconds.
I feel like asking what that is, but I don't think I should.
An attasecond is a quintillionth of a single second. So a one followed by 18 zeros.
Oh, that's fast.
That's like a bowl of Cheerios where each Cheerio is a zero.
Did you guys all get to see a Defense Advanced Research Project, DARPA, has a new running robot that goes 28.3 miles per hour, top speed.
Yes, faster than Usain Bolt. Except except that it doesn't carry its own power supply. So Usain Bolt still wins.
Okay, good. Glad to know. It also has no head, which freaks me out.
So someone's running alongside it driving alongside it
against
a battery?
It's on a treadmill, so it doesn't actually go anywhere.
Okay, so it's great at exercising.
Valerie Arora, thank you so much for being here today. Valerie, I've already introduced you, and I'll jump right into why did you become a programmer?
yes, so I'm one of the fortunate few people whose mother was a computer programmer. I have distinct memories of playing with punch cards as a 2 or 3 year old at the University of Arizona. So I always had computers around the house, but I never considered making it a career. They were just a thing you played games on, and maybe you wrote a little bit of BASIC that made the screen change color. The first time I actually considered becoming a programmer as a career, not just as something you do for fun on the side, was when I attended the third DEF CON conference. DEF CON is sort of the world standard for computer hacker, unquote, conferences.
Yeah, and we mean the hacker in the artistic, creative, and sometimes breaking the rules space.
Yes, DEF CON is one of the few places where all senses of the word hacker apply.
Yeah, and it's also referred to from, like, business people, it's referred to as the security conference.
Yes, and government agencies have been attending since, I don't know, at least the second.
Now we're at this was just DEF CON 20, right? So you were at DEF CON 3?
Yes.
That's pretty cool. That's geek cred right there. So you go the hell. Uh-huh. So you're, I would assume you're young at that point.
I was 17.
Yeah. 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 Okay. So how'd that make an influence on picking a career?
These were the smartest people I'd ever met. I'd been living in New Mexico, so there wasn't a whole lot of competition. And I know they seemed to be, I don't know, cool. But they wore what to me at the time seemed very cool clothing, like poet shirt.
A lot of black.
95. Yeah. A lot of black, a lot of leather, a lot of boots. But most importantly, they just seemed to be very interesting people who had full, cool lives. And they made a lot of money.
And they were talking about really neat things, right? Wasn't Kevin Mitnick in that time frame?
You know, I think he was still on the run at that point. I'm not sure. No, he'd been captured. There were free Mitnicks.
Yeah.
Stickers, I think.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was a bunch of people who were interested in how the world worked. And I learned so much that weekend, not just about computers, but I remember somebody explaining to me the social dynamics between QA, you know, software quality assurance, people who find the bugs, and programmers who make the bugs. And, you know, if you do things like pay people for every bug they make, they team up and create more bugs.
That was the QA perspective, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. All right, so that's your start as a programmer. You get into the file system, you do a lot of work in the open source community and make a career of it. Still every year going to DEF CON because it's awesome or not?
I continued to go while I was in college up to DEF CON 6, and then I discovered that other people were smart too, and started going to things like USENIX conferences. USENIX has an operating system conference.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most exciting things is I wrote a paper about the proper use of cryptographic hashes in operating systems, and ended up getting a free trip to Hawaii out of that.
Oh, nice. So then you start, basically you got your skill level up till you started speaking at conferences, and you get to pick any conference you want to go to, like Hawaii. Very cool.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, there's good incentives there.
Yeah, definitely. And what are you feeling about DEF CON now? what's the reason behind, I mean, this kind of leads into why you started the ADA initiative. Talk about that transition and that consciousness that you are now very aware of, and a bit of your article that described this to me very well.
Yes, so I went back to DEF CON about 4 years ago. It's probably DEF CON 16. I don't have the exact number in front of me. And to me, it was completely different. A lot of people were very rude to me. They were very rude to me simply because I was a woman. And it just kept happening the whole conference, and I was furious. I'd been used to being treated
like a human being.
Yeah, I mean, other conferences were also bad, which is why I started the ADA initiative. But DEF CON was the worst, and I finally left the conference after somebody confronted me about running Linux on my laptop and proceeded to explain why the women at his work were stupid because they ran Linux on their laptops, which, as anyone knows, that's actually a very difficult thing to do. And I just decided to leave and not come back. So
your experience was so negative about sexual harassment, basically, that you decided not to do this conference that actually, when you first were going, it initiated your career. I mean, it's not like the content of the, and that's the other thing, is the DEF CON content is actually pretty impressive. In fact, in your article, you list out all these corporations that are like, Twitter says, hey, we want a security expert, we'll be at DEF CON, come meet up. So it's not like you can remove yourself from DEF CON because it's a bad experience for a certain population and still participate at the full level of the career that you've chosen, for example. I mean, it's very it's an important conference to be at. And I think that's the argument against the whole, well, if it's not a polite place for women, then women shouldn't come, is a really stupid way of looking at it. I'm going to go ahead and quote something from your article, which is actually Casey, a journalist and student in San Francisco. This is what she wrote. Nothing could have prepared me for the onslaught of bad behavior I experienced, like the man who drunkenly tried to lick my shoulder tattoo, like the man who grabbed my hips while I was waiting for a drink at the EFF party, Electronic Freedom Foundation party, like the man who tried to get me to show him I'll use the words breasts here, she doesn't, so he could punch a hole in a card that when filled would let him net him a favor from one of the official security staff. That's part of the thing that's creepy about this, is it's not just nasty people showing up that happen to be nasty in the environment, like can happen anywhere. It's kind of supported in the culture.
Yes, it's unfortunately unfortunately, the culture is very ingrained around this, and the security staff doesn't have any training or incentive to handle this properly. Most people start out being unable to respond to something like somebody wandering around asking you to show your breasts. We'll keep being polite here, or grabbing your
rear end.
Your hips. I think it was another really polite way to put it. The one I called out in my article, people grabbing your crotch.
Yeah.
I mean, it really goes just as far as you want to go.
And what you're saying is that most people, when you're confronted with that kind of behavior, it's so shocking that you don't have a response that's, you know, supported, and especially when the card they're holding is they're going to turn back into the security guard.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, wait a second, this is really rampant and kind of disgusting.
Yes. There's a lot of argument about whether the security staff is or is not part of the problem. And it's pretty clear that at least some of the security staff is part of the problem. But whether or not that's the case, you absolutely have to be trained to deal with this. I have a story about my co-founder, Mary Gardner, who started the IT initiative with me, being in a talk at a next users group and having somebody show pornography on the screen, and she just sat there. I mean, she was an expert in this. She had written what you should do. She just in the moment, didn't know what to do. So
we have a different place when we're, you know, thinking in a safe environment, like our home or something. We're writing, we're thinking about ways of acting. And then when you're in a public environment, it's a very different experience. You can't do what's right. And I think everybody has that experience of being insulted or having something going on. And then 20 minutes later, they're able to go, I should have said, you know, that's a very common situation. We're a social creature. We're kind of inherently forced to be the way that the community around us is acting. And that's what's tricky about this is that it's hard to call attention to it. And, you know, one of the things that's really frustrating as a geek is that, I communicate with geeks a lot. We geeks love to nitpick little detail-y stuff and have this long debate about things like, well, you know, couldn't the person have spoken this way about it? It's like, that's not really the point is not to go into the nitty gritty of every single situation. The point is to see the overall emergent situation and go, there's something wrong with this whole situation. We have to change that, and not to pick down at these that result in comments like, well, if women don't like it, they shouldn't go. It was fun for me. That kind of ridiculous response that is easy to fall into, I think, especially for geeks to some sense, until they're shown these are the reasons why it's not okay. And that's what I love the article is about. It's like, this is why it's important that harassment shouldn't happen at conferences. You know, it's about why it's degrading it damages the experience for everybody.
Yes, I think I cannot emphasize enough how much going to conferences both helped my career and literally educated me.
Yeah.
And that I would not be where I was now if I hadn't gone to all these conferences.
I agree.
I have a box full of about 100 badges that I've kept from all of my conferences, and I've been broke at twice of them and had rather unpleasant experiences at another, I don't know, 20 or 30 of them.
Ben?
Yeah, this is something also that, based on what I've been reading, we're seeing at a more general level as well. Like, I read a lot of skeptical blogs and rationalist blogs, and these kinds of things are happening at those events as well, not just within the tech field.
Yeah. Well, there's something really interesting that you know, a lot of the experience of being, you know, humanist and also a geek, these qualities of you go, okay, I'm going to let go of all this preconceptions I've got about, you know, how the world should work. There's a lot of atheism, for example. So you're coming from a situation, you're raised a certain religious structure. You have to break those bonds, and you get together with all these people that feel the same way. And there's this idea that the social construct has left, right? I'm not saying that religion gives you some kind of sense of obligation of being human, because I don't think it does. But the idea of breaking all of your restrictions that you've grown up with and rethinking who you are leads you sometimes to not think about the reason why some polite behavior, some human, you know, qualities of treating everybody human is something that can be forgotten in that situation. And I think it's really important for an organization that says, you know, come together, we're going to talk about these really awesome topics. You don't normally talk about these with people because they're so esoteric, cryptography, whatever the topic is. When you get all those people together, you need to give some kind of formal structure of other rules of behavior. And that's what you've initiated. It's what you've done, a call to arms to some degree with the ADA initiative. You want to talk about that?
Yes. We work hard on giving people that structure and training that you don't have when you're just sitting there randomly and unprepared and somebody starts putting pornography up on the screen. We've done something called the conference conference anti-harassment policy, which other people renamed many interesting things. Some call it a code of conduct, some call it friendly space policy, things like that. It's, whatever name it goes under, it has it's fairly simple. One of the things we discovered is that often people doing these things had no idea that they were harmful. So right. The first part of it is just listing these common behaviors that people do. That, and oftentimes they think that it's even complimentary, like commenting on a woman's body. You've been trained. As long as you're saying that it's a pretty body, then it's fine. And they don't have any conception that it's putting people off. So that's the first part, is it has to be very specific about listing what these common misconceptions about what is okay. And the second part talks about what the penalties potentially are for this, something like getting thrown out of the conference or just getting a stern talking to or having your video not published of your talk, that sort of thing.
Right.
And that's up to the conference organizers.
Yeah, well, and of course, the presentation, the person that put up pornography as part of the discussion, that would have, if they had been submitting and this policy would have been in place at the conference, that would have been like, hey, this isn't something you can do. Like, you know, we don't swear on the radio. You know, it's part of the FCC regulations. But because we all know that, we just don't do it. You built into the system to some degree. But you were saying, go on.
Freedom. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, okay, so there's that whole geek response we want to be free.
That.
No, it's, yeah. let's talk about how ridiculous that stance is, because I think that's the inherent response of people in this, you know, society where we really say the government shouldn't censor us. Therefore, anytime we're asked to censor ourselves in any way, we go, well, don't affect my public. Do you have a response to that?
Yeah. What I find is that often people like us don't have a good understanding of context. I think of this a little bit like we're trained to think in terms of algebraic expressions, basically, or when we're doing logic.
Mm-hmm.
Problems. We think, well, I'm going to take A and I'm going to substitute in B, and then this thing should still be true. The reality is that there is context to your actions. You behave differently when you're talking to your family, when you're talking to someone you love, when you're talking at work. You use different words and different concepts, and the message that you get across, that we live in a society, and this thing we have created, a conference or an online community, is a society, and we work together to make that society. That's not something that comes easily.
Yeah.
So it really comes to I find that the best way to think about a conference, at least, is to say, hey, imagine this is a party inside of somebody's home. If you came to that party and you started saying these things or grabbing people or whatever it is you're doing that you think is part of your right as a human being, that's great. You can do that, but you also get to suffer the consequences of what you do, which is your person running the party kicking you out and not inviting you back.
You're making an assumption that geeks are invited to parties, though. I don't know if that...
Well, I know lots of geeks who go to parties, though.
Hey, I paid to get into this conference. I wasn't invited.
Right? I can be a jerk now.
And we mentioned this on the show before, but also wanted to make the point that if... Sometimes geeks, especially male geeks, do not get the point that banter, while it is a major part of discourse, mm-hmm. especially in a competitive environment.
Mm-hmm. And geek environments are intellectually competitive almost all the time. So go on.
Very often, yes. And even confrontational.
Mm-hmm.
But they tend to be competitive in that way of, well, my presentation was better than yours, or you just said something stupid, so I'm going to go after you. And when we're talking about sexual harassment here, this is not... even someone made a personal gaffe. This is because of who someone is, their morphology, how they look. They are being singled out and being denigrated on the basis of the belief that this entire group is inferior.
Right.
It is no better than if you were to make racial epithets up on. As part of your presentation, or you know, or that type of thing.
Yeah,
and that's something that a lot of people, especially male geeks, do not get. And I think also the male geek population needs to own that almost every single one of us—I won't put a blanket statement, but myself included—have made gaffes that would make people uncomfortable
yes.
for various reasons, and that includes women. And we need to own that.
Yeah.
And we need to say that, like,
I also
we
think
have done that in the past and we're not going to tolerate
and,
it in
and
the
I
future.
Also think it's really important for a male geek to take the time to understand what the perspective actually is, because you don't really get it until you really have to start putting yourself in a different place. I mean, one of the things I run into is that I am almost never, like, I don't know of ever a time I felt threatened by another human being who wasn't actually attacking me, right? Just walking near someone, I don't feel threatened. And that's not, mostly because, well, all they're going to really want from me is something I have, and so I can just give it to them. So I never have the mental perspective that human beings inherently are potentially dangerous to me. That doesn't enter my mind. So therefore, it's hard to understand that that's a very common place to be in. Human beings are scary. I mean, they're really scary. And so when you put yourself and you don't think the same way as another person, it's really hard to behave in a way that's appropriate. And so I think that's one of the things that it's behoovent upon you as a male geek to really understand this issue. To don't make a snap thought about this. Investigate and learn about
it. Yeah, it's a question of empathy.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's a question of lack of empathy. We're talking about how some people feel like they have a right to, or some people don't mean to, but they mean well, but they say things that are either insulting or make someone uncomfortable. But ultimately, it all comes down to, I think, a lack of empathy.
Yeah.
Because if you're a male, you don't have any firsthand experience of what it's like to be a female in a world that's in a field that's often
male-dominated. In much the same way as if you are... if you're white, you don't know what it's like to be black.
Mm-hmm.
If you're black, you don't know what it's like to be Latino. It's the exact same thing, and it takes effort to see the world from someone else's perspective.
Yeah, and I feel like in the last few months, in the communities that I'm involved in, the Rails communities, the JavaScript community, the Ruby communities of programmers, I'm starting to see a little bit more attention to this problem. And it kind of, you know, I have no idea if it's a trend. I hope that it is. But are you seeing, Valerie, are you seeing... conferences take on this this behavioral guideline that you're suggesting? Are you seeing any success in this area?
Yeah, absolutely. So we introduced this about almost 2 years ago. And right now, I believe it's easier to go to an open source conference with a policy of this kind than it is to find one that doesn't have one. It's also spread into the Wikimania. For the Wikipedia conference is another one that had it. The several science fiction conventions are having policies like this. And, other geek cons, girl geek cons, things like that. It's interesting because we licensed it Creative Commons Zero because we wanted no barrier to people adopting it. On the other side, it's kind of difficult to tell when people are using it. So I search for key phrases, and every time I look, I find it a few more dozen conferences using it.
Right. So you're saying is since your content is Creative Commons, anyone can use whenever they want. You don't have to get notified, and therefore you don't necessarily know. So you're just using Google to figure out if people are using it. It's kind of that's cool. So basically, if you see this policy in place, let the AIDA initiative know. Right. If you're at a conference and you see this, that this is a success.
You can also go edit the Geek Feminism Wiki page where we list these things. It's a very helpful thing when you're arguing for adoption. The other thing we found is that people are just say, "Oh, well, this is clearly the standard now," and it's much easier to get people to say, well, yes, that's a great idea.
Are you seeing a change at the conferences?
I believe so. Unfortunately, don't have the ability to do rigorous scientific tests, but each conference that has adopted these has reported back that they have more women attending. It's a very specific message that you're sending, that the organizers are going to treat you well. You are welcome. We have thought about people like you. And it's been tested a few times, and the results have been pretty good. The policy actually works, and each year that it's in place, fewer and fewer incidents happen. So,
yeah, I wanted to bring up that point of when you're talking about geek girl conferences, that you constantly hear, as soon as that's mentioned, someone come out of the woodwork of the internet and say, well, what about if we had geek guy conferences and that would be considered sexist?
That's the person that does not understand.
Yeah, that's it's this. But the conferences like DEF CON right now are a geek guy conference. Yes. And that's what we
need to
change.
That's the problem, yeah.
Yeah.
We are speaking with Valerie Arora. She's the co-founder and the executive director of the ADA Initiative, the tagline of which is supporting women in open technology and culture. You can learn more about the ADA Initiative at adainitiative.org. Of course, you can go up to geekspeak.org. I've linked to a few of the articles we're talking about. And Valerie, what you're currently, are you doing this as your full-time career, making this organization work?
Yes. The idea behind the ADA Initiative was to see what we could do with people who are paid to work on this topic. So yes, it's myself and my co-founder who is working part-time.
And it's a nonprofit, and I highly suggest if you like the topic we've had at hand, you want to support it more, please go to the ADA Initiative and donate to the organization to fund their mission of supporting women in open technology. Thank you so much for being on the show with me, Valerie. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And have we mentioned that ADA refers to Ada Lovelace, the first programmer?
Yeah. Awesome.
She was also the first open source programmer because she published her code.
Yeah, gotta throw that out there.
First open source programmer. That's cool.
First programmer who happened to also be open source.
That's awesome. Yeah. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Streaming and podcasting at kosp.org. This is Central Coast Public Radio, Santa Cruz, KOSP Santa Cruz. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence. We appreciate its use. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, Ben Jaffe and Miles Elam. Don't forget, take a look at geekspeak.org.